Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Peter and I are off on one of our usual walks down the Wolverhampton Canals, and it's still a bit mushy and leafy underfoot, so hopefully it won't be too noisy for the recording. Last week we did a podcast about yoga teacher training, and particularly how to choose your teacher training. And at the end of the recording, Pete said, a bit jokingly, a bit flippantly, don't join a cult, which usually ends badly. So it led me on to thinking, well, what if somebody wanted to ask the question, well, how do I spot a cult, and how do I avoid accidentally joining one? So that's where I was going to spring off from today.
Well, I suppose I should say at this juncture that the world of yoga teacher training isn't that culty as it goes. But you know, yoga in general over the last, I don't know, 40 years, you know, there have been a few culty kind of scandals gone down in the US, in India, in the UK, and probably in Europe. There's been a few, but really, you're not looking at Heaven's Gate, you know, or Jonestown or whatever, you know, as a general rule. But there is a certain possibility there, and you know, in the world of the spiritual supermarket, you know, the cult phenomenon is, it's a feature of the landscape. So what is a cult? A cult is a community or a group of people that exists outside of mainstream society in certain respects. And which is generally under some kind of authoritarian regime. It usually determines the behaviour and the thought and the customs and the beliefs of that particular community. So you might say, well, how does a cult differ from society at large, which does all that stuff anyway?
Yeah.
You know, there is... on the part of most societies, an attempt to engender a certain conformity amongst the citizens, because that makes the society easy to manage, makes it manageable, makes the division of labour manageable, makes an economy possible, so forth. But it's historically, most societies have done this through some kind of authoritarian control, you know, through the absolute power of monarchs, and through the coercion that a monarch or an oligarchy can muster to be the final sanction, which ensures conformity. Now, most societies realise that it's much better to have people conform, because it's just what they do. It's better that people consent from the point of view of the hegemon. It's better that people consent to being ruled in this fashion than they have to be continually forced into acquiescence. Obviously just 1,000 times more efficient.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
And that's why we've got religion. and so forth, you know, and shared systems of belief, customs, shared ethics, and so forth. So why is a cult different from society at large, since it's really only manifesting the same patterns on a smaller scale? Well, I think a small society comes under the rubric cult precisely because it's a small society. It's not the whole of society. It's mimicking the mechanisms and intensifying grotesquely exaggerating the mechanisms of societies, large societies, you know, full national societies or full tribal societies, whilst remaining separate and making a point of its separateness and its distinction within a much larger society. It's down to its size, basically. You know, Christianity started out as a cult, you know, and as a persecuted cult, and its members were viewed as eccentrics and subversives who needed to be punished, controlled, eliminated, etc. So the Romans had a great time throwing them to the lions for a spectacle, you know. So they had some kind of funny taste in entertainment.
Yeah.
But of course, it became the religion of the emperor Constantine and his wife Faustina, and then became the official religion of the Roman Empire, that it stopped being a cult. So it's to do with the the smallness of the group and the insistence of the group on distinguishing itself from the mainstream society. Now this leads to a feature of cult behaviour, which is, in order to sustain its internal power dynamic, what it has to do is it has to otherise the mainstream society. It has to say, we are different from them. We are saved. They are heathens. Maybe a cult then has an agenda of, our job is to save the rest of them, because we're the ones that know. You know, so you get an internal narrative that distinguishes the cult and the cult members from the rest of the world. And it's an us and them mechanism. And this is why when cults go wrong, they generally go wrong because they descend into paranoia. Because that us-them distinction gets stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. Yeah. And it's a way of dealing with internal tensions. It's to cast all the ills that the cult will inevitably experience, all the kind of conflicts and undercurrents of tension that the cult will inevitably experience. It blames it on the outside. It's them, it's the others, or it's the ones who have left. The apostates, you know, or the traitors. So this whole language of otherness, you know, of us and them. And that's what distinguishes a cult from mainstream society, because even though it's operating with many of the same dynamics, the fact that it's embedded in a larger society inevitably, unless you can go and buy an island or something like that, which of course does happen. And even then you don't escape it, because you take all the internalised mainstream social agendas and brainwashing with you. You know, it's not like running off to a cave or buying your own island, that you get rid of that internalised society. You know, so in a sense, any cult member is both the us and the them in some respect. So you can say of the paranoia that's kind of quite characteristic of cults when they start coming to an end, how it's a function of the otherisation of mainstream society that a cult has to do in order to put a boundary around itself, and then in order to justify its own mode of doing stuff. The other thing that they do, the other way that cults sustain themselves, is through a grand narrative, just like mainstream society. But of course, it's one in which the us and them distinction plays a very large role. And of course, mainstream society does this as well. You know, the paradigm case is Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Whereby the another is defined and then blamed for everything that goes wrong, for everything that doesn't work. It's never us, because we have got the perfect answer, the perfect paradigm, the perfect grand narrative, the totally watertight set of explanations. Now, as I said, a feature of a cult, which would distinguish it perhaps from a modern democracy a little, is the degree of authoritarian control. Now, modern democracies are still play authoritarian games. You know, societies are not free of it. But it does get a little bit attenuated just by the fact that citizens every now and then fucking shout up, you know.
Yeah.
Occasionally they even do stuff like rebel and take to the streets and so on. But a cult echoes an earlier form of social organisation, like kingship, because there's usually a guru. You know, there's one person who is deemed to be the authority, and either the guru is God, or a stand-in for God has got a hotline to God. I mean, in the modern world, the Catholics are still doing it, you know, when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, he's thought to be infallible, because God is telling him what to say. You know, so it's just like this game that's being played, because it gets played in a small group of 1,000 or 2,000 people who are kind of locked in, who've been persuaded very deeply and very thoroughly by various psychological techniques that the grand narrative that the guru is selling is the fucking truth, capital T. And you see, you know, everything's all set there for a complete absolutist authoritarian control administered by the guru. And what you get here is a language of surrender. You get this notion that you will be saved and drawn into the bosom of the cult by surrendering to the will of the guru, by completely abdicating your own will.
And that's a really good thought, because that's an excellent way to be able to spot a cult,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, if you kind of get asked to do anything like that. Bear in mind that everybody who's done it will tell you how intoxicating it is. And they'll be browbeating you with their stories of their very intense and beatific experience as the Shaktipat or whatever it is descends.
Yeah.
And of course there are tricks, psychological tricks, for producing extreme emotional and rapturous responses in people, just by building up loads and loads of tension, first of all, with the promise of some release. And this is a trick you'll find endlessly, you know. They nearly all do that. It's like you're hovering on the edge of some cult, a friend has joined perhaps, or some of your peer group's joined, and you're thinking, oh, I don't know about this. But they're all kind of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and telling you how great it is. And,
yeah.
And how the light and the infinite love and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And they'll keep laying this trip on you, and then you say, okay, I'll go, I'll join. And then they keep you waiting. So what they'll do, they'll keep you waiting and build the tension. Build and build and build the tension. You know. And make the struggle that you're having, whether to go for this thing or not, more and more intense. And intensify the desire on your part to have it. To have what they've had. Or what they tell you they've had. You know.
Oh, they might even believe that they've had it.
Well, they've had something, because they've had a massive emotional reaction.
Manipulation.
Yeah, but through this manipulation of increasing the tension and then suddenly releasing it.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes you feel, it's very intense. It's very intense, of course it is. If you walk from here to Chester in a pair of shoes two sizes too small and then you took them off, it is an experience of kind of relief and release. But it's the relief and the release of an artificially induced tension through the psyops that they do on you. And if you spot that, I'd get your arse out of there quick.
Yeah.
You know, and go and examine yourself and figure out why it is that you're susceptible to that.
Yeah.
No, I'd say most people are susceptible. Most of us are kind of quite needy. Human beings, you know, we're needy. We're codependent. We like to be liked. We want to be loved. We want to belong. It's the kind of animal that we are. We're pack fucking social animals, you know.
And that's exactly the thing that cults prey on, though, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you'd be surprised, you know, some modern cults, just how well educated the members are and how socially integrated. Now, they've done really well in life, but at some level, there's a disappointment. At some level, there's a feeling that whatever belonging that they have isn't nurturing them. You know, it isn't. It's unsatisfying. It's like white bread when you want something more, something you can chew on. It doesn't have the richness that the part of you maybe remembers and certainly craves at some level. So even these kind of pretty smart people can get sucked in. And it's because we, you know, very, very many people are needy and codependent. And a guru figure is somebody who's likely to realise all this at some level, either actually consciously or at some subliminal level sometimes, and is somebody whose need is to wield authority and power. They get their rocks off like that. So you've got like a marriage made in hell between codependence, which is most people, more people are followers than leaders, and somebody with an equally deep psychological need to be powerful and to exert power and to exert their own vision and through a kind of will to power, impose their own vision at least on some part of reality. So those two things, if they come together, you get the cult, yeah. And because the rest of the world is likely to look a little bit askance at this, you then get the us-them thing. Plus, there's the internal dynamic. By creating an us-them distinction and a siege mentality, the cult leader can get more obedience from the members of the community. Bit like what happened in World War II in Britain, you know. I mean, the UK was probably poised for all kinds of socialist mayhem prior to the war, and Germany certainly was. So people who wish to avoid that scenario panning out can quickly get the mass of the population to put their aspirations for freedom onto the back burner in the name of the greater good. The national good or the war effort. And you get these kind of extraordinary circumstances in which you get like an apparent breakdown of class distinctions and all this kind of stuff. You know, they always pull out the thing of the Queen, who was then Princess Elizabeth in the war, working as a mechanic, you know, yeah. And doing her bit, and much propaganda is milked out of that. So you can see that, you know, that us-them siege mentality, we are at war with the rest mentality, produces the cohesion that the hegemon, you know, the powerful centre of the society actually wants and needs. But as we say, you know, when the scale isn't big enough, you get paranoia. And when you get paranoia, you get some kind of eventual breakout, you know, violence, you know. I mean, and there are some kind of spectacular examples, you know, the Jonestown thing.
Yeah, you sent me that that YouTube video. was it like the top 10 worst cults of all time. It was quite an eye-opener.
Yeah, I mean, 900 people killed themselves there at the behest of their guru. This was the extent of the power of the guru, was that he could induce 900 people to take cyanide and give it to their
children.
To their children. And then the Waco thing, you know, 50-day siege, and it ended up looking like a fire, you know. And then what was that, I forget the name, but that Japanese cult whereby they let poison gas off in the Tokyo subway.
Oh, yeah.
And killed hundreds and hundreds of people. Because their kind of paranoia had reached such an extent that the other had to be eliminated.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy, he was running that cult in his paranoid fantasy. He thought he could get all. He was trying to get all the nukes.
Yes, I know. Yeah. That was a very scary one, that one.
Yeah.
But all of those in that video, they had a charismatic leader who had promoted himself to godlike.
The godlike
figure.
Status. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is why because yoga is open to this kind of thing, because surrender does play a part in yoga. Even though I would say, you know, surrender to the universe, you know.
Yeah.
Don't bloody surrender to some kind of like fucking sociopath who happens to have like a sweet and beguiling surface appearance.
Yeah. I wonder if you could protect yourself against that kind of thing by asking awkward questions.
Well, which question, I say?
Because if you are accidentally engaged in a cult, asking awkward questions will probably get you kicked out eventually, which would be a good thing for you.
Yeah, try your best to get kicked out.
Yeah.
But question, of course, question. And that's what Viveka, you know, again, he's one of Patanjali's methods, is being able to apply discriminative awareness. Being able to, or satya, the practice of satya in Patanjali, is one in which you are responsive and open, and therefore vulnerable. But you're also aware of all of your responses in that vulnerability. You know, go as best you can for a clear look at the total situation you find yourself in. At any point in your life, really, and that's vis-a-vis whatever communities that you're engaged with, what if you're engaged with you know, a spiritual guide, whatever, this kind of thing. Have that kind of clarity of satya, of truthfulness to yourself, and that ability to draw distinctions, viveka, work with those, and take into account the whole situation, which includes how you're feeling, what the rest of the community is doing, thinking, how the teacher, guru or whatever is guiding that or informing that. Place that in the context of the rest of society and what their stories are. Place that in the context of nature and of your own animality, your own passions, your own desire, your own appetites. And have a go, as best a go as you can, of truthfully looking at the totality of the situation that you're in. As a question, don't be frightened to question. If you get people that are saying to you, don't question. No, this is the mind. This is the mind. You must leave the mind, go into your heart. You know, and then you are a real sucker for what's coming. Even though, I do say, Patanjali, again, one of Patanjali's methods is surrender. It's surrender. But in Patanjali's case, you know, there's none of this guru shit in there, to be honest with you. I think the guru shit is more to do with the patriarchal, authoritarian nature of Indian culture and the way they do everything than it is to do with yoga. Certainly Patanjali's yoga is not authoritarian. It's always urging you to inquire and to find out and giving you some kind of sketch maps to help you with that. But that's it. There's none of this guru shit. You know, which of course plays right into our infantile desires to belong and for the world to be a safer place than it actually is and as it actually ever will be. So that's it. If you hear this thing, don't question.
Run away.
It's time to backpedal. Question.
Yeah. And that's how you can protect yourself. Yeah. If you feel that you are vulnerable to
and you should,
overwhelmed.
You should. And surrender means surrender to the universe, and it's surrender to your own deepest integrity, which is like the inner guru, you know, it's Ishvara. Surrender to that, surrender to the intelligence of the universe as it manifests through you. And that makes sense, that will show you everything. That will show you everything, but watch out for these beady-eyed sociopaths. When I was a young yogi, I asked my mentor for a piece of advice. He'd give me a piece of advice. Our teacher. And he said to me, never stop questioning. Never, ever stop questioning. Promise me you will never stop questioning. Wow.
And you never did?
No, I haven't. And because at that time, you know, people were flocking off to various... sit at the feet of various like nutcases and we're all full of this questioning can get you nowhere, give it up scenario, you know, and ending up throwing their lives away in some cases, in other cases getting we have to say this, sometimes deriving benefit. And of course people, parents and society at large, can panic when somebody joins a community. And not all communities are malign. You know, there are people who have been in communities for decades, and it's made their life. It suited them. They're not all, as I said, they're not all malign. This is a way for some people. I was watching the thing about Ted Patrick, who was the 60s doyen of cult busters, of deprogramming. And some of the people he dragged off. I mean, he would actually kidnap people. He got arrested a few times for kidnapping. Because the parents...
To get them away from the cult.
This was the 60s. And, you know, on the back end of the totally conformist 1950s. And then all this kind of weird hippie stuff. Parents, the older generation, was totally alarmed. And you can see how they were alarmed. It was so alien. And then they found the kids, you know, were working in the kitchen in a commune somewhere for no pay, 16 hours a day. And he interviewed a guy like that who'd been kidnapped by Ted Patrick. And this guy... when he was taken home and quizzed and deprogrammed, and he just went along with it. He didn't really believe it, but he played the part so he could get out. And as soon as he had his opportunity, he was back. You know, since he got his opportunity, he went back to the cult, and he was there, and he learned a lot about cooking and this and nutrition. And at some point, he decided he'd go walk about and see what the world was about, and worked as a chef in San Francisco and New York, and learned even more stuff. And then he decided that he'd become a doctor, so he became a doctor, and specialised in nutritional medicine, nutrition. Got his own practice, and he said, "Now this guy's now in his 50s or his 60s or whatever, yeah, now in his 60s, I think." Saying, "Well, you know, I didn't get to be a doctor till I was 35, as opposed to 25, if I'd have not done that. But look at all this stuff that I learned about nutrition." And he said, "I still go to the ashram for a retreat once a year. And every year he goes for 2 or 3 weeks. And he says, I still meditate every day." It had worked for him. Because that group wasn't as malign as his parents thought it was. Because it's so alien to anything that they understood. It's like a full-on Indian-style Bhakti cult, you know. And a bit strange if you're a middle American Republicans, you know.
Yeah.
But it panned out all right for him. But that individual, it worked for him totally. He had that space to explore and a bit of a framework within which to do it. And as you said, it gave him a ready-made family of people who he really liked and all the rest of it. So not all communities are malign. But there is a dynamic in communities when they're enclosed in the greater society and they're at odds with it in some way. There is a dynamic to do with otherisation. And there is a dynamic to do with neediness, codependency on the one hand, and what I could kind of loosely call sociopathic power hunger on the other hand. And this thing will play itself out. It plays itself out in society at large. And plays itself out in an exaggerated fashion in small communities. So, okay, just summarise your tools. You're somebody who's decided to self-inquire. It's a burning hunger for you. It's not just a fashion accessory, remember. It's a real thing for you. Remember Viveka. Remember questioning. And if you think surrender is your way, surrender to the universe. Find the universe inside yourself and surrender to that. And keep your wits about you.
Yeah. Keep questioning.
Keep questioning.
Okay, well, I hope that was useful, particularly for anyone who is looking for a spiritual teacher and is a little bit concerned about the cult problem. So hopefully that's answered a few questions that you might have had. All right then. Take care, everybody, and we'll speak to you soon.